And welcome back for the next episode of the Power Flow Podcast. I'm your host, Amy Simpkins, and I'm here today with my friend and colleague, Kay Aiken. Kay is the founder of Introspective Systems, LLC, and Chief Product Officer of Dynamic Grid, a software company based in Portland, Maine. She's a graduate of Pennsylvania State University and holds a degree in energy and sustainability engineering. She has spent her career as an energy engineer, architectural designer, and business development executive, currently chief product officer of an AI-based complex system software company focused on energy control software. Over the last few years, working with partner Dr. Carol Johnson, they studied the application of AI and complex systems to the integration of distributed energy resources into the electrical grid as an expansion of her experience in sustainable technologies. She is recognized as a transactive energy expert and as a regular speaker at conferences on this topic, as well as distributed intelligence in the electrical grid. She's on the board of the GridWise Architecture Council. She's one of 13 members setting overall direction for the Department of Energy in the areas of grid modernization and smart grids. She's also a member of IEEE Power and Energy Society, Smart Electric Power Alliance, Seismological Society of America, and she's an active participant in SEPA's Transactive Energy Working Group and Microgrids and the Grid Edge Group for the Interstate Renewable Energy Council. Welcome to the podcast, Kay. I'm so excited for this conversation.
Well, I am too, because we have to learn to figure out how to collaborate more. I've always been very impressed with you, and you are the rocket scientist, and I'm a lowly engineer, but I love your work.
Oh, thank you so much. And likewise, you can tell, listeners, there's a ton of mutual respect here. Kay and I first met, we sat together on the board of the Distributed Energy Conference through Power Magazine for a few years. And you could tell, like, when that group met, that, like, every time Kay said something, I would light up and, you know, be like, yeah, that's it. And every time that...
You're probably cringing going, oh, God, she said that again.
No, it's... I think we beat the same drum in a lot of ways, which is really excellent. So I want to start out and just dive deeper into your areas of expertise, because I love it. And you have such a wealth of knowledge and experience. But so, you know, unlike me, this is somewhere where we differ. You know, I came into energy from aerospace, and I kind of came into it later in my career. But you've sort of been here kind of the whole time. You know, your education background is in energy. So tell me about that. Tell me about, you know, getting interested and living the dream from the beginning.
Well, unfortunately, I had to take a hiatus in the middle because I graduated in 87 from Penn State with that degree. And I was the first graduating class of that program. And there were three of us, and none of us could find jobs. So I had to build my own job when I got out of college. And that turned out to be design build. That's where my architectural design process work came in. But interestingly, I took a hiatus and went to aerospace for a short period of time because I was working for British Aerospace.
Amazing. No, totally. And I have discovered, and I mean, it's sort of making my transition was easy because there are so many similarities between the way that aerospace kind of works and the mission objectives and the criticality of the mission and the reliability that come over into energy, in a lot of ways, similar mindsets come over. So it surprises people, I think, from my perspective, but it does tend to be a pretty graceful transition, I think.
Mm-hmm. You know, I totally agree. I was working for BAE Systems, I was helping their venture capital arm that doing technical due diligence. And one of the projects I worked on was doing technical due diligence on a microgrid energy company. So, you know.
Absolutely. We like to say around here, like, spacecraft are just microgrids in the sky.
Yeah, exactly.
And aircraft exactly. As well. So, yep. So tell me about the companies. Now, we've got two, you know, I'm definitely familiar with your work at Introspective Systems, although I want you to talk about that. And then now we've got Dynamic Grid. And so I'm really excited to hear about kind of what's going on. And
so this is really our transition path. So Introspective Systems was what Carol and I, Carol Johnson, who she was a systems engineering fellow at BAE Systems for many, many years, but she's actually a geophysicist. Our software at Introspective Systems currently runs about 80% of the seismic networks in the world currently. So we locate earthquakes in real time. One of our large projects is for the National Earthquake Information Center. We do all the real time data analysis for them and locate earthquakes for emergency responders. We do similar work for the Air Force and then regional networks. So we started out there. Carol was working for BAE Systems, and Introspective was really the offshoot of the work she was doing in the military on complex systems. So we did a lot. We started out as a research firm. We had about 10 people doing heavy duty military research, government research, and private research. Trying to understand what complex systems meant, and systems of systems and multi-agent systems and things like that. All the things you talk about.
Absolutely.
And Dynamic Grid actually was an offshoot from, started out as a small business innovation research grant in 2016 that, you know, I got lucky. Some people will know the name Chris Irwin in the Department of Energy and Office of Electricity, OE. And he's a big guy on transactive energy. And we kind of flipped the script a little bit on that CBER, where he was looking for communication systems for interoperability purposes. And we said, well, let's wait a second. Let's redesign the grid architecture first. Let's start from the beginning. And we got an award.
That's amazing. And that's like the classic case of like the customer thinks they know what they're asking for, thinks they know what they want. And you're like, the thing that you asked for was not actually the thing that I think you want. Let me tell you about what you want.
Right. Like, so we kind of got lucky. We had, as Chris said in his reply to me, he said the reason why you received the award, you weren't ranked at the top because you didn't answer the actual problem that was in the abstract. But you got it because I don't want the next grid. I want the next grid.
Ooh, that's good stuff.
Yeah. So he's been our patron saint for a while now. I'm hoping we should have known last week whether we were going to get a Connected Communities Award.
Amazing.
But they've been delayed for a couple of weeks now.
Oh, man.
As we speak, by the time this goes on live, we will already know or not know.
Fingers crossed for that. And, you know, God bless them all over at the DOE. And because it seems like everything is delayed over there, they must be absolutely strapped.
Yeah.
So tell me more about, I mean, our listeners are definitely, you know, in the energy industry, but some are not. So tell me more about like Dynamic Grid. Tell me more about the transactive energy piece. Like, let's get down into the weeds a little bit.
So let's frame this into the problem that I see in the future. We can right now, solar and wind is cost competitive, generally, right? In most locales. Generation really isn't our problem. Some of it is going to be transmission, and the Biden infrastructure plan is talking about transmission, moving power, say, from the Midwest, wind power from the Midwest, and moving it to the East and vice versa. But in my mind, the real problem is going to be on the distribution grid, because we're going to be adding, we're doing beneficial electrification. We're converting the transportation system to electricity, and we're converting our space heating, our space conditioning to electricity. And that is going to, NREL just came out with a study not too long ago saying that our overall loads are going to increase by 38% by 2035. Mm-hmm. But what's really going to be a problem is we're going to increase our peaks by up to three times. Everybody comes home, 5 p.m., they plug in their EV, and guess what? It starts charging. And we're going to blow transformers. Everyone has a little tub transformer out on your pole, and it's what's a 15 kVA transformer. And by the time you put your heating system and your EV charger on, you've gone through over the capacity of it.
Right. So it's not just a overall juice problem. It's a time problem.
It's a time problem.
Yeah.
So we've created an architecture and the AI behind it to help manage all that time and do it in real time on the distribution grid and completely localized. So the two big keys is when we're talking millions and millions and millions of devices, centralized systems don't work. I mean, we in the computer industry, we talk about, object-oriented programming, you know, and that's the idea to be able to encapsulate services, split them up so that they don't, you don't have a critical failure in the entire system. The system can fail gracefully. You know, ERCOT didn't fail gracefully. They took a sledgehammer to it.
They did not. Yes, that's true.
Oh. But if we had real-time pricing and dynamic loads, what we call in the industry grid flexibility or demand flexibility, we could keep some level of service to everybody without cutting a certain group of people off. And basically it comes down to, if I really want the power, if I have a, you know, I don't know if anybody has iron lungs now, but if you have an iron lung, you are a high priority. You get power, period. But my refrigerator may not get power. My car won't get power, you know? So you can actually have the system fail gracefully based upon the amount of supply you have. So that's what we're developing at Dynamic Grid and rolling out now in demonstration projects. And hopefully the first utilities are coming in the next year.
Oh, it's fascinating. This is such important work, you know, because part of the question that I, you know, that I wrestle with is, you know, how do we shift almost the total architecture, right, of how we buy power, generate power, distribute power. And this is part of the answer. Part of the answer is around this type of control. So I have a list of questions here for you just based on what you just said. The first one is about, you know, you talked about transmission, working with transmission. And so as we talk about moving from a centralized architecture to a more distributed architecture to, to address these issues that we're talking about, that there's no single point of failure, how does the role of transmission change? And how does the transmission landscape? Because right now with these, you know, centralized power plants and then, these high voltage transmissions lines to carry power over just tremendously long distances, for no apparent reason, right? Which
is very inefficient.
Very inefficient and creates system vulnerabilities, you know, and more points of failure for that system. And so I'm curious, you know, as soon as you said transmission, I was like, ooh, you know, how does the transmission architecture also shift as we shift from centralized to distributed architecture?
So I don't think it's either or. So Rob Gramlich and I debate once in a while. You may recognize that name. Do we have a centralized future or do we have a decentralized future? We actually have both. They both have a play because centralized solar plants and centralized wind plants and offshore wind like we're doing here in Maine are going to be large projects and they're cost effective. So that's going to be the majority of the bulk power. We're going to replace our coal plants and our natural gas plants with large grid scale solar and wind and geothermal to a certain extent. But we still have this distributed because we still have to get the power to the houses. So that's where distributed comes into play, where the solar cells on your roof will help provide power to you and maybe to your neighbor or vice versa, and limit the amount of peaking we have on the distribution grid. So it's a win-win in both sides. We're going to still have bulk power because it's going to be cheaper than putting it on your roof. But you're going to have your roof to help mitigate problems that are on the distribution grid. And then when you add demand flexibility to that equation, now you can actually manage it and not rebuild our infrastructure. The numbers I've been looking at is it's going to be $500 billion to rebuild our distribution infrastructure if we do nothing.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. That leads really well into my next question, because now you mentioned it again, and that is, you know, dynamic loads. Something, you know, in my own work, talking about dynamic loads or dispatchable loads is a pretty new concept for a lot of people, especially. And, you know, I work mostly like behind the meter. And I know your focus is both, really. You're talking about that interface of grid side to client side, you know, both sides. And so, you know, when we are talking to behind the meter clients, you know, it's easy more or less to talk about dispatchable assets, you know, and say like, oh, well, you might need, you know, some kind of energy storage along with your solar so that you can dispatch that energy generation to when you need it. And that sort of almost assumes that your loads aren't dispatchable at all. There's some addressing of dispatchable loads at the buildings level, you know, with building management software that says, oh, hey, I'm going to actually think about when my my control system is going to think.
Yeah, we always personify our control systems. I always talk about that.
Okay, rabbit hole here. I am going to talk about that for a minute, because you're right. I do personify my control system because I feel like it's, you know, it's got intelligence, right? It's artificial intelligence. But that confuses people a lot because they really do think that they as a human can think their way through the problem of how to dispatch the loads, dispatch the assets. And like, if they just think hard enough, like they're going to sit in there somehow and flip their own switch, you know, when
as smart as humans are, we're not that smart, unfortunately.
And even if we are that smart, we're not that fast, let's be honest. And we have better things to do. Like, who wants to sit there with their finger on the button all the time?
And watch it. You know, watch a dashboard going, oh, the price is high right now. I better cut down on my power use.
Exactly. And so I think it does confuse the client, because I'll say like, we need to think about how the building is operated. And they're like, oh, well, I do think about that. And I'm like, no, the computer has to think about it. There's this initial foray into dispatchable loads, you know, talking about building management systems. When, you know, can we be smart about when the air conditioning runs? And can we be smart about, you know, even just simple things as turning lights off and motion sensors when people walk into a room? So that technology exists. But beyond that, when I start to talk about dispatchable loads or dynamic loads, I find that it tends to make people nervous, because they're like, like, you're going to tell me I can't charge my car. I can't run my refrigerator. I can't turn my air conditioning colder. And so how do you see these dispatchable loads? How do decisions get made in a way that doesn't, well, piss people off? Let's be frank.
So what we're doing is you set your parameters. So I want green power. Ultimately, what we're creating is a coordination signal. So we create a signal. It happens. We call it a price. Or alternatively, to make it softer, we call it an economic dispatch value, which is a little more utility centric, you know? And basically, your AI in your house, okay, think of it as a nest, a super nest, okay? But it's localized. So you have complete control over it. You set the parameters. If you want to override something, you override it. Just do it. You know what it's going to cost. You have a little dashboard that says, you know, power is really, really expensive right now. It's been cloudy for 3 days. We don't have enough storage. Your solar collector is not producing enough. Do you really want to run your jacuzzi? You know? Again, I'm personifying the control system, but it will alert you and say, do you really want to do this? And you say, you know what? I don't care about my comfort. I don't care about my price. I've got enough money. I'm going to run my jacuzzi, period. And you do it. So you have the complete control. We also have another thing is all of our systems are isolated to the building or isolated to the device. So that it's fully cyber secure. All we receive from the utility is a signal saying power is valuable right now or power is cheap right now. And the AI in your house react to that. There's no signal. There's no control by the utility. You know, the direct control and NLX now, they do direct control. They basically, some controller in the sky says, guess what? We're turning your hot water heater off. But I need hot water right now. Our system doesn't do that. Our system goes and says, you know, price is really, really high. I won't heat your hot water heater right now unless you really want it heat hot. So that's fully cybersecure. We call it security by architecture. And that was one of the things we really, really, really focused on with the Department of Energy is making the architecture secure inherently. Trying to put firewalls on edge devices is a fool's errand. We'll never, ever get there. There's not enough money in the system to make them fully secure.
Yeah, I hear that.
I mean, my security clearance is now in China. I don't know about yours. But my security clearance is now in China. You know, I think it's 128 pages of every detail of my life. So, you know, the Office of Personnel Management couldn't protect my security clearance. So,
yeah, it's definitely an issue. So this is absolutely fascinating. And we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to talk about more about the economics. I want to pull that thread a little bit. Okay. And we're back with the Powerflow podcast. We're talking to Kay Aiken today, the Chief Product Officer of Dynamic Grid. And we are talking about grid modernization and intelligent dispatch of dynamic loads, real-time pricing, moving to a hybrid centralized and distributed architecture. And I want to come back to what we were just talking about, which was this concept of an individual user on the system getting a pricing signal and being able to decide whether or not they use some piece of equipment, whether that's in a commercial or industrial setting or at a home in a residential setting. And I want to pull on that thread a little bit and talk about the economics. And, you know, you had brought up earlier the ERCOT disaster. Let's just go ahead and call it a disaster. over the winter, and part of that disaster was that in the Texas electricity, purchase exchange, there was a platform available where residential customers who had never had market exposure before could sign up on a plan where they were exposed to real-time pricing. And what made everyone throw their hands in the air was that they signed a contract that said, yes, I would like to be on real-time pricing. And then when it spiked up to $9 a kilowatt hour, people cried foul that those people should have known better or didn't know any better. And It was, the system was somehow trying to take advantage of them when this is what they had signed up for. Another example, my utility at my house, we're on a rural electric co-op out in Colorado, and they just made a time of use rate available on the residential rate tariffs. So it used to be a flat 12 cents, no matter the time of day. And now it's 7 cents, except for 4 to 8 p.m. when it's 30 cents.
Okay, so I'm going to be putting your my control system in your house next week.
Well, okay, sure, I love that. Except you, well, you know me. We already at our house, you know, we have installed smart switches everywhere, and like, you know, that are programmed to shut down at 3:58 and come on at 8:02, and like we're having fun hacking through the whole thing. But not everyone is like that. We have a Facebook group for the members of the, you know, members of the co-op to kind of exchange information. And most people think it's punitive. Most people think they're somehow being punished. And we're like, are you kidding? 7 cents electricity. Like,
it's an opportunity.
It's an opportunity.
Honestly, it's an opportunity.
So my question here, after the whole long ramble about, you know, people in Texas who signed up to be exposed to market pricing and then got really, really upset when they experienced a downside, and people on my new time of use residential tariff who feel like they're being punished, how do we shift that narrative? Like there's a cultural narrative that you shouldn't have to pay attention to when you use power. So can you address feel free to address any of that. There's a lot of questions in there.
There's a lot there to unpack. The problem with dynamic pricing is, one, how the pricing is implemented. So in our system, we have what I call guardrails. So we provide low-end and top-end protection. So the problem with Gritty was they had no insurance for the big spikes. Any plan you do should have insurance. In other words, there should be a fund or a circuit breaker where the retail customer doesn't get hit with the bad, the really, really bad stuff. But they also, on the other end, may not get the complete lowest number when the price goes negative. In California, very often the wholesale price goes negative. So you might not get negative prices. You might only get a penny a kilowatt in that situation. So it's all about how regulators and utilities create the guardrails for a system. You also actually, in my system, so we have a project that I'm hoping will come back. We've been talking about a project in Maine for 3 years now that politics changed and it's just a mess. Microgrids are amazingly hard to get built.
100%. Hallelujah.
Especially when you have communities involved.
Oh my goodness, yes.
So they provided a flat rate, but the utility was able to actively manage their loads in exchange for a lowered flat rate. So that's how they did it. So there's lots of ways you can build a tariff plan so that the consumer has both the benefit and none of the bad side of potential real-time pricing. But this also, even real-time pricing has the opportunity to, you can use it as an opportunity. You can put the storage in and you can actually play the pricing. And that's what our controls are about, is using in the field we call transactive energy, basically building a market. And I share with you, you share with me. We, in effect, back in the 50s, most of our work has been designed off of a man named Kenneth Arrow. He won the Nobel Prize in the 60s somewhere, but his paper called Competitive Equilibrium is from 1954. And it's how multi-agent systems work in an economic system to find the clearing price. So we're talking economics here. Find the clearing price for goods and services. And we use those type of ideas with smart systems, smart AI-enabled systems, And we have a device on the utility that's setting a price. It doesn't know how things are going to react exactly. It's making a prediction of that. And then edge devices that are saying, oh, I can see that price, and they react. And eventually the two come together and find a clearing price, which is the actual price for power at that moment. So things that can handle a high price will run. Things that can't handle a high price will lower. And the prices will vary. In effect, the ask price and the bid price will vary. Now, we don't use two-way communications. This is all done passively. Mm-hmm. I debate with my friends at Pacific Northwest National Laboratory very often, who have done some really, really good work on transactive energy, where they use two-way communications in bidding. And I think that's a wrong path, because we can't have enough communications to do that. You start talking billions of devices, the communication system is going to be terrible. It's just going to be huge. And we're going to have the cybersecurity problem. We're going to have to put firewalls on every single edge device. So we built this secure by architecture system where we only send a price, and the clearing price in a local distribution network is, in effect, discovered over time by the two devices in this competitive equilibrium. And they find the equilibrium. It's secure. It works fast. It gets 80 or 90% of the problem. And the rest can be handled by current products in the marketplace, tap changers, changing voltages, SCADA systems, distribution grid storage. They can solve all those problems. Smart inverters on solar grid systems. So we're not trying to solve 100% of the problem. What we're trying to do is make the problem 80% better very, very quickly and very cheaply.
So who is the, how does this get deployed? Your technology is mostly the edge side or grid side or both?
It's both. So we're currently talking to utilities, and I don't know what utility you talked about Colorado. I'm actually talking to a Colorado co-op. So hopefully, I don't know if I can I mention Brian Hannigan and Holy Cross?
Well, I will say maybe, go ahead. That is not my co-op.
Okay.
But I know that Holy Cross has been the center of some pretty innovative stuff. Like they walk out there on the edge fairly often, pun intended.
Yes. So utilities, I wish this was video and wasn't just audio. I would show you some of my stuff, but the utilities put out in their substations and on the distribution grid, they put in small devices that fit in the palm of your hand, that have processors in them, communications, as well as sensing capabilities on the power grid. So they sense the power flow in the power grid. And they make an estimate of what's going to happen in the future, what happened, and they know what happened in the past. They understand the power flow at that moment, and they set a price that lower-level devices listen for. Whether it's an actual edge device or it's another utility gateway at a branch circuit, but it's fractal. And we started out with fractal grid, but of course that's a trade name for somebody else.
I love that, and it makes so much sense to me.
Yeah.
So
I mean, it's a thing that software engineers have done for years, of breaking large complex problems down into smaller problems. You build an F-35 military jet, it's a pile of subsystems. It's a systems of systems.
Exactly. It's reflected. We were talking, and I wanted to get at the end here before we close up, I want to talk about, innovation theory and stuff like that. But that gets back to my sort of innovation theory nerd hat, where it's also biological. It's as above, so below. It's, the architectures of galaxies match the architectures of atoms, and mm-hmm. The fractal nature of the universe And here we are again, like the fractal nature of technology and software and architectural systems. That's the stuff that I really nerd out on.
So my co-founder, Carol, who unfortunately died about 18, 19 months ago, she developed a system for Office of Naval Research for finding mines in the littoral combat zone, so in the surf zone, right? And the inspiration for it was the mantis shrimp that sees polarized light in, I think, 27 different ways. So she used hyperspectral imaging to look for mines. And basically what she did is she made water disappear. She used the glint off of the waves and eliminated the glint with a camera running at 10,000 images a second. And she removed all the glint, and what happened was the water just disappeared, and you just looked down, and you could see the mines on the ground, in underneath the water. Mm-hmm. And the inspiration was the mantis shrimp, of how it saw polarized light and how it was able to handle all of that image information coming in. So that's the idea behind. We can learn so much from biology and how our world works as an ecosystem if we just look for it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. So how do we get there? That's kind of the final question. I mean, you're working diligently to deploy this technology right now, to test it, to put it out there. So what are the first steps? I love the vision that you've cast here of, you know, the future grid, the future, especially from the economic side. You know, how does the market drive this, and how does the distributed hybrid grid of the future work? All that is super interesting. So how do we get there from here?
The big problem, which is a big push that I'm doing in Gridwise Architecture Council, is to engage regulators and state legislators. Because a lot of it is going to be, I mean, ERCOT, Gridly kind of hurt the idea of real-time pricing. Oh, no, I'm scared. But it's really the way we have to make power. Just like our capitalism system, you know, and maybe some people might argue capitalism is a flawed political process.
But it's what we got.
But it's what we got. And generally, it works really, really well. It's about providing guardrails, you know, and the Federal Reserve is a guardrail on our economic system. So we do the same thing in our energy system, and it will work very, very well if we can get regulation to change. In other words, in most states, almost all states, other than demo projects, dynamic pricing is not allowed because regulators are scared of it. Mm-hmm. Regulators are scared of the pitchforks of consumers coming in saying, like the Gridly folks, wait a second, I was charged $9 a kilowatt. I didn't know. Well, yeah, you didn't know. You didn't read the fine print. But it's not that the idea was flawed. It was the execution of the idea that was flawed.
Right.
And that's what we have to concentrate on, is doing it the right way. And that's really outreach to regulators and state legislators to allow these changes. Because the bottom line is, you know, I said $500 billion in just improvements to the distribution system to handle EV chargers and space heating, right? That's a lot of money.
It's a lot.
It's a lot of money. We can do it for $50 billion. You know, just think about it. You put your DC fast charger at your local supermarket, and you put 20 of them, and you have everybody go and fill up at the same time. You got to build a new substation.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
You know? Let's you know, I'm all for moving our buses Seattle's talking about moving all their buses to electric buses. But then they realized that their depot, they had to run a new transmission line to their depot in order to handle the charging infrastructure. And they dropped
it. I have had that exact conversation with two other transportation districts. Exact same thing.
Yeah.
That, like, the power company said, no, you can't do that. We just don't have the power to put there.
I talked to a developer in the last month that is being charged $1.5 million here in Portland to install. It's an all-electric building, and they need to put in $1.5 million of new infrastructure, three blocks away to another distribution circuit in order to get power to their building.
Oh, oh, it's painful. I'm bringing it back around a little bit, but I totally hear you about, like, engaging regulators, because I 100% agree. You are speaking my language, as always. We of course expected that, but allowing the market to shape the landscape, but with guardrails. And so, you know, figuring out how to bring in those guardrails, but then even prior to that, getting regulators on board with the idea so that we can even have an intelligent conversation about what guardrails should look like is so important. But what do you think about, like, the cultural shift of, like, your everyday people? And that could be residential customers or it could be commercial customers, because personally, I've found that neither really understands how they pay for power or buy power or even where their power comes from very well.
They don't. And I think we're just getting out of the early adopter stage now. People are starting to get it better. I mean, the Nest thermostat was really, you know, at the beginning, they took away all of the idea of price and all that stuff, you know, what is the cost on optimization and everything else. I think we're now ready for the next step where people are a little more aware of what their choices mean. People are deciding, am I going to buy an internal combustion engine car or am I going to buy an electric vehicle? And they're making that choice on a daily basis for themselves. And I think they need to be able to start doing that and have the dashboards and the information to make that choice in their house. I mean, every day, I'm single now. I, wash my dishes every 3 days or something.
I have three small kids, so we're like a two dishwasher run a day family.
Yeah,
like
I know. I'm done. My youngest turns 21 in 5 days. So.
Oh my goodness! Oh wow.
So I hit the delay button. Now I'm not saving any money with it, but I know if I hit the delay button, it's going to be better power. You know, it's going to be wind or it's going to be nuclear power that's running as base load. So I'm doing something by just hitting the delay button. And I think people are getting to the point where they understand that the decisions they make with their finger makes a difference.
I love that. I'm writing that down. The decisions they make with their finger make a difference. Perfect. Well, on that, I want to ask you if you have kind of final thoughts to wrap us up. This has been an incredible conversation, as expected. And so what are your final thoughts here for the listeners on, you know, moving us forward?
I will start with the title of my book. And Amy and I were talking before, we're both writing books on innovation, and hers is a little ahead of mine, but my book is called Innovate, I-N-O-V-8, Beyond the Edge of Envelopes. And we have to start thinking beyond the edge of envelopes. And there's a really quick story about that. During the memorial service for my past partner, One of her friends said that the singular value of Carol was not that she wrote on the back of envelopes to solve problems. She wrote beyond the edges of envelopes. And in fact, she found envelopes that no one else knew existed and wrote past the edge of those envelopes. So that's kind of the idea. We have to get out of our parochial views of the world and really look beyond the edge of envelopes.
Mm, beautiful. And I would argue that everyone's kind of got a different envelope.
Everybody has a different envelope, yep.
And as long as you're writing past the edge of yours, you're contributing to the solution.
That's right.
Oh, beautiful. Where can people find you, Kay, if they want to continue this conversation?
My email, I'm free with it, kay.aikin@dynamicgrid.ai.
Amazing.
I'm also on LinkedIn, and I'm not sure, but you look up Kay Aiken on LinkedIn, and please connect. And Twitter, too, @KayAiken.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for being with us today, Kay. It was really, really great to talk to you. Thanks, everyone, for listening to this episode of Powerflow Podcast. We'll see you again next time here at the whiteboard.
Thanks, Amy.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of the Powerflow Podcast. If you enjoyed the conversation, please share the episode with other innovators, leave us a positive review, and subscribe to Powerflow on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can find show notes for this episode, more great conversations, Powerflow merchandise, and more at powerflowpodcast.com. Powerflow is hosted by Amy Simpkins, produced by Devin Shanchuk, and managed by Laura Novak. See you next time here at the whiteboard.